David's wondering whether you would like to offer any initial reactions at this point. Okay, not yet. Yes, thank you. Yes, in the green shirt. Anne, okay.
Question to the last...
Sorry, your name.
Oh, I'm Franz from Austria. I'm an activist in the socialist movement. And the question goes to the last speaker. I would like him to substantiate the claim that the two options he referred as socialism and fascism are no longer valid. Because I think first we have to go into detail what we mean with fascism or neo-fascism and also with socialism or Stalinism. And why do you think it's not valid anymore that the general polarization between the developments in modern capitalism and imperialism? Because I think that it's very complicated, especially with fascism today, because there is a change in class relations. And the same goes with Stalinism. But I don't think that there is a general guarantee that a revolutionary movement can degenerate along the lines of Stalinism in the 20s and 30s of the last century. So I would like you to substantiate this this position. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Anna, where is Anna? Question from Anna.
I'm Anne Vogelpohl from the Center for Metropolitan Studies. You, in the last presentation, mentioned or said that the role of theory must be to redefine the notion of revolution. And David Harvey said that one revolutionary moment can be these gradual changes. And in other texts of yours, you mainly speak about the democratization of the surplus use and the surplus production. And I want to ask you, David Harvey, if this is your notion of revolution, this democratization of surplus value, or is it just a practical suggestion because we mustn't believe in utopia and such, because you don't really use the word revolution in this context. And I ask myself if this is your notion of revolution or if you see this concept as useful or not.
Thank you very much. Yes, Catherine.
I really appreciated your all these talks. Thank you very much. And to Roger, because the arguments that you're making about thinking about global cities in a relational way is one that I want to also talk about tomorrow. And I wanted to take this opportunity to ask you if this kind of thinking has helped you to think about political responses as well in a relational, and by which I mean translocal way. So you talked about avoiding authoritarian responses, but I wonder if you, in the work you've done on SARS and so forth, you've also either come across empirically or thought about theoretically what a relational political response might be.
Okay, maybe one or two more questions before we turn it over to the panelists. Yes, Peter.
The example that David Harvey gave is one that strikes home to those of us that teach planning and very often are in similar situations. And it seems to me very difficult to raise the questions that he raised in that context. There is, for instance, no way that I know of to ask someone that is being asked to design a physical city to deal with the question of property rights. It seems to me his six criteria transcend issues of the physical design of a city and need to be brought into it some other way.
Anyone else before we turn it over to the panelists? We'll do another round, but anyone else in this round? Yes. Oren.
Yeah, Oren Iftachel from Beersheva, Israel-Palestine. Thanks very much for the talk, the three talks. I wonder if we are in this rare moment that we can reflect on critical theory with the input of Marcuse, Harvey, and the other great speakers. Can we reflect perhaps of what was missing in the great thinkers of the past, and what in the reflection in the two talks already, the second and third talk was already starting to emerge, things that were missing, but perhaps be more explicit. And also Peter Harvey, going back to Das Kapital, but what should we add to Das Kapital today?
David,
Okay, I think there are three questions. On the question of the surplus, on this point, I think we should understand that the history of capitalism has been about a 3% compound rate of growth. A healthy capitalist economy is one that grows 3% per year. And throughout the whole history of capitalism, that is what it's averaged. There have been periods when it's not grown at all, and we may be headed into one of those right now, but that's the average. Now, 3% compound rate of growth on the basis of all the activity that's going on in about a 50-mile radius of Manchester and a few other places, is no problem. Think about 3% compound rate of growth on the top of what is now a $40 trillion global economy, which was in 1950 a $4 trillion global economy. You're looking at 3% compound rate of growth on everything that's going on in China and much of the rest of East and Southeast Asia. You're looking at everything that's going on in Europe. You're looking at everything in North America and much of South America. Just imagine what that 3% compound rate of growth is going to be look like. And one of the arguments I've been making is that actually the transformation of urbanization, the urbanization of planet Earth, has been driven by the need to try to absorb that 3% rate of growth. Now, this comes out of the fact that capitalism is about the production of surplus value, and you produce surplus value by producing a surplus product, and you've got to absorb the surplus product. So it seems to me that something is going to have to happen about the production of surplus product and the production of surplus value. And to the degree that the history of socialism and communism has been about actually confronting that question of surplus value production head on, I think we've got to come back to that. We've got to come back to that. And instead of nibbling around the edges, this is where the real revolution is going to arise. And frankly, if we can get democratic control over the production of the surplus and the distribution of the surplus, that will be an astonishing revolutionary thing to do. And it's going to take a real strong revolutionary movement to do it. But the problem, I think, is that most radical thinkers don't even think about that anymore. In other words, going back to the question of socialism is no longer possible, well, one of the things is we've forgotten what socialism is about. And socialism was always about controlling the surplus. And who and the people who produce the surplus should have the right to the surplus. And we know who they are, you know. So this is where you come back to a rather conventional view. I'm sorry, but we do. And we've got to get back there. We've got to get back there. Because if we don't get back there, we're not going to be able to confront what seems to me to be the huge problem, which is that, for instance, these fiscal crises we're in, we've been through many fiscal crises over the last 30 years. They've got bigger and wider and deeper, and they're going to get much worse. If we come out of this one and manage to get back on that 3% compound rate of growth, we're going to get another one down the line, which is going to be even bigger. And so something's going to happen, it seems to me. Something big is going to happen, and it could be an authoritarian kind of corporatist, state-led, capitalist, class-led world, which is going to be very uncomfortable to live in, or we're going to have to be back to a kind of revolutionary project, which is regaining control over the surplus. Peter, I disagree with you about you can't... I mean, I know you get frustrated living around sort of architects and planners and all the rest of it, and I do too, but they can, for God's sake, be educated. You know? They really can at some point, and actually when you can get them to think about it, they actually do start to come up with some interesting designs, and there are some interesting people out there sort of thinking about these things, about, you know, so I think that is, really important. And there was one other question. What was the... Well, I'll pass it over to... And if I think of it, I'll come back to it.
Okay, the first question that... was put to me was, why do I think that we can no longer think of the future in terms of the socialism and fascisms that we knew from the last century? The short answer is, you know, because Peter Marcuse had told me so last night. But I think let me tie this to some other questions also that came up. I mean, even if you look at the revolutionary politics of the early 20th century, inspired by Marx, you know, the people who produced these revolutions, the Lenins, the Luxembourgs, and so on, you know, this, both the successful and the, you know, not so successful ones, they didn't have a theory of politics that they inherited from Marx. They didn't have a, you know, the 20th century revolutions could not rely on a 19th century theory. They had to create a concept of politics for themselves. And my basic point is that today, in the 21st century, we have to do the same. The challenge is for us to imagine a theory of politics that that we can no longer really find from, you know, books written in the 20th century, much less the 19th century. So this relates to the question about, you know, what do we want to add to Capital when we read Capital today, right? And I think a theory of politics above all. And by this I don't only mean a theory of the state, but you know, what to do and how to do, how to organize and bring about broad-based collective radical change in society and space. And this is, you know, obviously a very serious question that I can't really, you know, deal with like this. But at least I can say that this is where I see the need for a lot more work. And I have in my own, like, recent spare time reading, you know, kind of nibbled away at one tiny corner of this problem, which is, you know, I've always felt that as a kind of a Marxist urban scholar, actually I'm an architect by training, I should have prefaced my, you know. So I'll let you judge if I had been educated or not, but you know, I've always felt that, you know, the more sophisticated our theory, you know, the less depressing our prospects for politics. You know, because we are very good at explaining how the world came to be the way it is, you know, with you know, going back to Capital and, you know, other things, but that doesn't necessarily give us a theory about what to do today and now, you know. And this is where I find some of you know, so I ask myself this question, you know, who today is trying to propose a new theory of politics, you know, trying to redefine what a revolution, how we might think about a revolution today. And it is in response to this question that I am drawn to, you know, a few people, but above all, Alain Badiou, you know, rightly or wrongly. You know, I mean, I'm not sure what I think of him. I mean, I'm engaging him, and I found that essay written by Peter Hallward, you know, following from Badiou to some extent, called The Politics of Prescription, somewhat enlightening, you know, and offers some hope. So that's where I ended my presentation.
I'll get up because I can't see most of the people over there. Thanks for the question, Catherine. That is, to some degree, the basis of my comments. And it is not by prescription, to follow up on this, that I find it urgent to think about these things, but because it's by observation. Because when we started doing this research on SARS 4 years ago, 5 years ago, we weren't aware of those new forms of network politics that exist in this field. Now, I must say two things. Number one, I'm not a believer in the flat Earth theory of scale. I actually am quite an opponent intellectually and ontologically of that form of thinking. I don't believe that everything is in networks and everything is flat, and the ontology we need is a flat ontology. So that's out of my system now. I do, however, think that, and I also don't think that some, even though I borrow from people like Asha Amin and others on questions of relationality, I will not follow these thinkers all the way in terms of devising a new politics out of this, because I think they're kidding themselves over the actual structures scales and so on that exist to hinder these kinds of things from becoming fruitful. That's just to make that clear. However, you can observe all kinds of new politics, and I give you just two examples out of the SARS context. Last week, I was at a meeting of the WHO. That's official politics. It has nothing to do with the kind of politics we're talking about here, but it's networked. The World Health Organization, which is a UN organization and hence organized through nation states, and everything that the UN does goes up the hierarchical ladder, down the hierarchical ladder. So when there is a SARS case in Hong Kong, it has to cross the border to Beijing, and then a long, long way from Hong Kong, and then it has to work its way through the bureaucracy in Beijing. They, if the WHO is lucky, will tell the Southeast Asian office of the WHO, and then it'll go to the WHO. And a few days later, after we've had already a disaster or an outbreak or something, you know, we'll know. So the WHO now understands that it's more important, perhaps, to also create networks of cities talking to one another and invite people like me, you know, and most, I was the only social scientist, it was like with the architects, there were only medical people, and I was a social scientist, it was an interesting experience. But that's sort of, they're now beginning to understand at the official level. At the sub-political level, and, you know, I think that in terms of politics, there's another sort of issue here, which is what Eric Swingerdow has been writing about a lot recently about post-politics and also refers to Beck's sub-politics. At the sub-political level, it was very interesting during the SARS crisis that all the research labs that look for the causes of diseases linked themselves up by 24-hour email contacts around the world all the time, completely without any regard of borders, without any regard of national governments and their security concerns. Even the American CDC, which are the most reclusive of them all, joined into this dialogue. So this was a sub-political expert dialogue, which saved a lot of time, and it was the first, I mean, it was an unbelievable speed, I think about 3 weeks until they determined it was a coronavirus that caused this disease, which helped a lot in, you know, counteracting the disease. And that's sort of the last point I want to make. It is absolutely fallacious, and it's absolutely, an illusion to think we can only operate on the level of the network, because the reason why, amongst other things, that SARS was contained was because of the enormous presence of scaled forms of institutionalized healthcare that exists in, you know, in each city. So, like in Toronto, you had, this was a hospital-based outbreak. And so it was the organization and the very organized, not networked, very hierarchical form of organization that helped contain the virus. So yes, networks play a role, but they also need to be viewed against the other structural constraints and also structural opportunities that exist in there. Just one more thing, all politics is always embedded in particular ways. So the politics of networks or the politics of fighting infectious disease in cities has to be looked at in the context of how is labor in the healthcare sector organized. So one of the things we learned is that neoliberalism in Ontario, which is the province in which Toronto is, was decimated by neoliberal, the healthcare system was decimated by neoliberal reforms, and the work, the labor in these hospitals was casualized. So in fact, there was a networked form of labor as nurses were going from various hospitals. They had 4 hours here and 4 hours there, and actually carried the virus from hospital to hospital. So you had a networked form of neoliberal labor market organization, which was part of the problem for which other things might have been a solution. So it is a dialectical way of looking at these things, and I wouldn't go either this way or that way. Just to Oren's point, I think the main thing is not to be disciplinary, not to rediscipline ourselves. And the point that Neil made at the beginning, I think, is very important. Not to go back into geography, sociology, political science, but to create a transdisciplinary discourse on these issues. And a really new, fresh view of how this is being done. For example, Jenny Robinson's book, On Ordinary Cities, which I think fulfills many of the promises of this kind of a transdisciplinary view of the urban world today.
Thanks, Roger. Yeah, I was going to ask you that.
It does. Oh, okay. I just want to add something about the Marx question. Of course, you need loads and loads of information and ideas and theory that goes beyond Marx. But in order to say that, you first have to understand what's in Marx. And there's a certain impatience with the suggestion that there's a lot in there that we haven't really mined very well. For example, I've taught Marx's Capital, Volume 1, for nearly 40 years, every year now. And it was only about 15 years ago that I started to talk about that footnote. If you go to my Marx lectures, which are now available on the web, you'll find Lecture 8 spends most of the time on that footnote. Because when you look at that footnote, you suddenly reinterpret everything that Marx was doing in the light of that footnote and say, well, that is how he was understanding the transition from feudalism to capitalism. It was over all of those different moments, and actually it becomes a really fantastic theory, which also, by the way, allows you to critique what happened in communist societies. They did not take account of the interactions, the dialectical movement that would occur between those elements. It becomes a fantastic way to actually sort of critique what's happened and also to start to think about how to construct a revolutionary movement over a long period of time. So I didn't get that footnote until I'd been teaching this text for about 20 years. And there's a lot in there of that sort in Marx, which is really, really very interesting, in which you go, when you go back into it, you kind of actually start to see new things and new ways of seeing. So yes, we need a lot more outside of, but just don't kind of say, oh, that's Marx, you know, we all know what's in there, because we don't really know what's in there. And actually, over the last 20 years, unfortunately, because of that funny word you put up there that you didn't want to talk about, we haven't really been reading Marx very seriously and very carefully at all. And I think that that is indeed a bit of a problem, because there is so much in there which is tremendously insightful, including notions about the surplus and all the rest of it and what a radical politics must be. And I agree, there's no definition in there exactly of the politics, but of course Marx had plenty of politics in his other writings. So, we've got to be careful not to kind of say, well, we know all of that, we've been through that, we've come out of that, we don't have to be bothered with it anymore. No, I think we should be bothering with it a lot right now. It has a lot to tell us and a lot to teach us, even though it's not everything we want to know.
Thank you, David. So we have about 5 minutes left, so I'm going to ask the next round of questioners to try to be as concise as possible, as well as the panelists. We've got to stop in about 5 minutes, so the floor is open for one more round of quick ones. Yes. Bob. Is there a mic?
Yeah. Bob Cattrall, editor of the journal City. I want to throw in a note of caution. I think we shouldn't be too self-congratulatory about where we are. We're lucky in that the world has kind of thrown up the problems that we said were always there. And for the moment, very few people deny that the situation is the kind of situation that Marxists have often described. But that's it's a partial reason for self-congratulation, but it's not a very big reason for self-congratulation, because how the hell do we fail to convey to people that our analysis was correct or useful? So we've got to be asking that, and we've got to be asking whether there are ways of talking about critical urban theory that are part of that problem. If I attempted to give an example, I would take up too much time. So can I just, is it useful just to leave it there?
Yeah, I think so.
Right.
Thank you, Bob. Other questions? Yes.
It's more a comment than a question, because I'm an architect too, so I'm really interested about the discussion, and I think that to discuss with architects about the right to the city is really important, because when you discuss with architects, you are discussing about morphology and you are discussing about squares and crises, but it's important because the knowledge of architects is not are not words, but it's the physical material. So this is what we are producing. So to discuss with architects in that way is really important, just to get switch in this material too.
Thank you very much. I feel like I'm calling on a lot of people in the front. Anyone in the back? Yes.
Yeah.
Was there?
I have a question to Peter Marcuse. I'm Philipp Schmidt from Bauhaus University. And also this question goes to Kanisha Gunevardhana. I was reading, I was a little bit shocked when I saw their radical urban praxis. Peter Marcuse is a radical urban praxis. And my question...
Excuse me for interrupting.
Yes.
Peter asked that you please stand up. It'll be easier.
Okay.
Here. Thank you.
Here I am. Good. Oh, okay. So, standing now. I need some space. It's always a question of space. And I was a little bit concerned and shocked to see... is radical urban praxis. And I'm asking if it needs to be radical, this urban praxis, because the right to the city maybe is just a question of freedom also. And what I learned in lectures at Peter's courses in New York was the freedom to think. And I think this is really important to mention, or the freedom to think about what you want to see, what you can observe, and regarding a totalitarian system, Herbert Marcuse now in a context where you have no freedom, it would be really important to think further beyond the system and to think in different terms. I think this must not be radical.
Thank you very much. I think we should turn it back over to the panelists. Any last comments that any or all of you would like to make in response to anything?
Well, let me just say something to Bob. I mean, you know, yeah, we shouldn't. I mean, I think the bad thing right now is we just sort of sit back and put our feet up on the table and say, yeah, I told you so. Of course there are contradictions in capitalism. Of course it produces crises. You know, that's the stupidest thing we can do. On the other hand, this question of why it is that we did not manage to maintain, as it were, the kind of intellectual and analytic presence in the field is a big question. And frankly, I think we've been through a whole generation almost of what I can only call the betrayal of the intellectuals, frankly. And I got pissed off, I have to say, because some of my colleagues, I won't say who, from... an island, which I won't mention, who have been telling me, you know, oh, you old Marxist, you're full of, you know, crap, you know, and you're a dinosaur, and why don't you get with it? It's all about culture. It's all about this and that, and blah, 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 blah. And now I get these emails from them, and they say, yeah, you know, I suddenly pulled out the limits to capital, and I thought I'd better go back and read that stuff in order to understand what the hell's going on. And I'm kind of going, screw you, you know, you should have been doing that all along, you know, and they don't. And I kind of go, this is an incredible betrayal, which has a lot to do with the neoliberalization of the university and the corporatization of the university and all of that kind of stuff. But there was almost no resistance. There was very little resistance. And I think we were paying an immense price. And, you know, some of us have struggled. And actually, some of us, in spite of our reputations, have been pretty much marginalized in our own disciplines because we're just seen as old-fashioned old dinosaurs, sort of old farts going on about, you know, Marx again, you know. And but this is a real problem, but it's one of the things where we've got a real big job to do right now to recuperate some kind of notion of how to go about analyzing this, and we've got to start retraining people so that they can really work through this stuff and understand both what's happening, but also, you know, how we can move from here to somewhere different.
Thank you, David. Any final comments from Roger or Kanishka?
Just quickly.
Yeah.
I think that we have to be radical, but it doesn't mean that we have to go out and, you know, throw stuff every time something happens. But radical in the sense of, you know, be radical in thought. So it's very much in common with what David just said. But then to be very careful with the kind of politics that we devise, because in the past we have made some mistakes in, you know, shooting before we've thought about the right strategy and the right tactics that may not always have to be as radical as it seems to us in the analysis. However, there are lines that cannot be crossed. And to come back to my very first remark, if there's a strike, and when there's a strike, there's a line in the sand, And then you don't cross that picket line. And you have to be absolutely radical about that. And you cannot negotiate while, you know, that sort of thing is laid down. So I think it's a question of strategy and tactics and different levels of analysis.
So thanks, everyone, for a great...
Well, following Roger, I also think it depends what you mean by radical. You know, the for me, and I suppose for Marx too, you know, there's no, you know, freedom is radical. The and with Marx, what you have is a critique of the liberal democratic, you know, the bourgeois notion of freedom, an immanent critique. The you know, liberal capitalism or liberal democracy promises a kind of freedom that it cannot deliver in social life. And Marxism is a critique of that. So in that sense, I don't see a radical difference between radical and freedom, right? So the and also following on David's comment on Capital, and of course, you know, I certainly agree that it's very important to read Marx, and I do this all the time, you know, and I read other things in my spare time after reading Marx, like I said. So and one I was reminded of one comment, however, from a student of mine, you know, who was in a reading group in our university, reading Capital, which I unfortunately could not attend because I was on parental leave last year. So, but after this year of reading Capital, Amy, my graduate student, came and told me, "See, Kanishka, I didn't really. It was a great experience reading Capital, but I didn't really find much about the working class there. You know? It is all about, you know, like it's more about the bourgeoisie, you know, and you know, and I actually." You know, my first reaction was, no, you haven't read it properly. You know, there's a lot about the working class, you know, about the working day and, you know, all that stuff. You know, it's a great book. You know, don't, you know, give me this, you know, biased perspectives, you know. And but then I went home and thought about it a little bit. Well, maybe she had a point, you know, and of course, maybe even Marx had a point. Yeah, because the book is called Capital, not Labor. Right? So in this, it is in that spirit that I said, you know, we need to think about politics.
Thank you, Kanishka. Sorry about that. So thanks, everyone, for a fantastic beginning to our two-day conference. I think we need a 15-minute break. So my proposal, and Margit, tell me if you support this proposal, because we're trying to do teamwork here, is that we reconvene at 11:30. What do you think, Margit? Yes? So 11:30... I'll be looking for you right here.
Can people take their seats, please? And while people are still trying to find their seats and calming down, let me make an announcement, because we have a little problem, because the hallway outside of this room happens to be the emergency flight exit place. So the police, the campus police, has asked us to move the registration table and where you go and get your candy and fruits for during the breaks inside. So they'll later be in the afternoon, they'll be in this room. And then after, once you grab your nourishment, would you then please mosey around the wonderful hallways of this main building of the Technical University and not all cluster right outside here where it's supposed to be free so that people can move through. Thank you very much for doing that. So we really do have to move on because at 6 o'clock we have to be out of here. There will be a lecture class, and we committed that we will give them this auditorium in as tidy a fashion as we found it. So let's move to our second panel. We are now, give me the program, looking at critical theory as a legacy for the whole discussion that we are opening up with this conference. The order of speakers is a little turned around because some of the papers, unfortunately, you know, arrived late. So we will start with Neil Brenner, who comes from NYU, is part of the Transatlantic Graduate Program. You've already heard him.
Ah,